Hey everybody, on today's episode of the Cherry Pickers NBA podcast, I'm going to be giving you my thoughts on the upcoming NBA free agency market, discussing some of the best available players, talking about some of the contract implications, and going over my predictions for where each free agent listed on my big board is going to end up going. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Cherry Pickers NBA podcast. It's that time of year again. We've reached the point of the NBA season where it's considered almost the off season, and players now have the contractual ability to sign with new teams and start new chapters of their career-long journeys. And hopefully we're going to see in today's analysis of who's available, what they may go for, and where they may go to, a little insight into what the NBA of the future may have in store for us. Let's get into it. I felt like the best way to get into explaining who's available is to break down team by team who exactly is a free agent, and who is like a restricted free agent versus unrestricted, who has that ability, and where may they go. So we're going to go alphabetical order, starting with the Atlanta Hawks. Their only free agent this season is Aaron Holiday. Next with the Boston Celtics, you have Grant Williams, who is restricted, and Blake Griffin. The Brooklyn Nets, you have Seth Curry, Cam Johnson, who's restricted, and Yuta Watanabe. The Charlotte Hornets, you have Kelly Oubre, Dennis Smith Jr., Svi Mihailuk, Miles Bridges, and PJ Washington, the last two being restricted. The Bulls, you have Patrick Beverley, Javonte Green, and Derek Jones Jr. You also have Kobe White and Ayo Dosunmu, who are both restricted, as well as Andre Drummond, who has a player option. The Cavaliers, you have Caris LeVert, Danny Green, and Raul Neto. The Dallas Mavericks, you have Kyrie Irving, Markieff Morris, Dwight Powell, Frankie Smokes, that's Frank Ntilikina for you guys that weren't aware, Christian Wood, Theo Pinson, and the other Holiday that isn't Drew, Justin Holiday. The champion Denver Nuggets, you have Jeff Green, Reggie Jackson, Thomas Bryant, Bruce Brown, DeAndre Jordan. The Detroit Pistons, Corey Joseph, Hamidou Diallo. The Golden State Warriors, Dante DiVincenzo, Draymond Green, Jamichael Green. The Houston Rockets, Boban Marjanovic. The Indiana Pacers, O'Shea Brissett. The Los Angeles Clippers, Mason Plumlee and Russell Westbrook. The Los Angeles Lakers, Lonnie Walker, D'Angelo Russell, Troy Brown Jr., Dennis Schroeder, Tristan Thompson. You also have Austin Reeves and Rui Hachimura on restricted deals, and Malik Beasley with a team option. The Memphis Grizzlies, you have Dylan Brooks. The Miami Heat, Max Strus, Gabe Vincent, Kevin Love, Udonis Haslem, and Omer Yurtseven, who's restricted. The Milwaukee Bucks, Chris Middleton, Brooke Lopez, Javon Carter, Wesley Matthews, Thanasis Antetokounmpo, Joe Ingles, Jay Crowder, Myers Leonard, and AJ Green, who is restricted. The Minnesota Timberwolves, you've got Austin Rivers and Jalen Noel, as well as Nickeil Alexander-Walker, who's restricted. New Orleans Pelicans, Josh Richardson, and Jackson Hayes, who's restricted. The New York Knicks, you've got Derrick Rose, Miles McBride, who has a team option, and Josh Hart, who has a player option. The Oklahoma City Thunder, Dario Saric. The Orlando Magic, Goga Badadze, who has a team option, and Mo Wagner. The 76ers, Georges Niang, Jalen McDaniels, Shake Milton, Montrezl Harrell, James Harden, who has a player option, and Paul Reed, B-Ball Paul, who is restricted. The Phoenix Suns, Torrey Craig, Terrence Ross, Damian Lee, Bismack Biyombo, Josh Okogie, Darius Bazley, who's restricted, as well as Jock Lundale, who's restricted. The Trailblazers, Justice Winslow, Jeremy Grant, Cam Reddish, who's restricted, Matisse Thybulle, who's restricted, Kevin Knox, who has a team option, and Nasir Little, who's restricted. The Sacramento Kings, Harrison Barnes, Terrence Davis, Alex Len, Trey Lyles, Kessler Edwards, who has a team option. The San Antonio Spurs, Trey Jones, who's restricted, Kata Bates Diop. The Toronto Raptors, Jakob Poeltl, Will Barton, and Fred VanVleet. The Utah Jazz, Juan Toscano-Anderson, and Jordan Clarkson, who has a player option. And last but not least, the Washington Wizards, Mike Muscala, Kendrick Nunn, Kyle Kuzma, and that's your list. That's everybody who is important that's available. Now, it is important to note that there are a few more restricted player and team option guys that are going to be available, but they're like the Sandro Mamushkevelli or Jay Huffs of the NBA, where they're guys that doesn't really matter where they're going to sign. They're going to be end of the bench if they're even still in the league beyond this point with the new influx of talent from this year's draft, as well as any two-way guys that may have just come out. So as far as players of note goes, that's everybody who's worth mentioning. Let's get into the teams that have the most cap space. The most recent projection put the NBA salary cap for this upcoming season right around $136 million, with the luxury tax threshold starting at $165 million, and that second apron around $182.5. If you're unaware, teams that exceed that figure are going to have a few different roster restrictions in the upcoming seasons that will change both with the year as well as the rate that you are into the tax. With the CBA, they specifically mention that if you spend beyond the second apron, you're going to lose the ability to match the salary flexibility within trades, so you don't have the ability to aggregate and add up multiple pieces to equal a contract. You lose your taxpayer mid-level exception, and you are unable to sign players from the buyout market. This is something that is going to be a rather large adjustment for many NBA teams, especially those that have championship pedigree, because something that's been rather common for at least the last decade of NBA basketball is the front-running teams picking up the scraps of bad contracts, players that no longer wanted to fit within a team's construct of a rebuild, even though they're a contributing player, then being waived and signing with a contender within the buyout market. This means that a player that has championship pedigree and level of play, such as a Kevin Love moving to the Miami Heat, would not be a move that's possible to make. If you are paying into that second apron and beyond, you are penalized in ways that the NBA has not come after franchises before. And that's without even mentioning that flexibility within the trades where you cannot add up multiple salaries to equal or eat one larger salary, basically rendering a trade for a theoretical superstar or visible upgrade impossible. And I promise you there is not a single team in the NBA that is willingly going to sign off on giving away the rights to their mid-level. Even though it can be an overrated asset at times, you can go back and look through the history of who may have been signed on an MLE. It's generally a mixed bag of results. It still is a valuable asset to have because it is, at the end of the day, going to be a roster spot that if you end up signing somebody, your hope is that they fill an important role on your roster. Because of these imminent impending changes to the structure of how NBA payroll and salary figures are adjusted, teams did not have the ability to prepare for years in advance this quick and swift carryover into the upcoming CBA. The memo for the CBA was officially first sent out on Wednesday, June 28th, the same day that I am recording this podcast. Teams without the ability to plan ahead that for years, ate salary at the expense of their owner's wallet to attempt to be the best contender possible, and in the long run, duplicate or increase the value of that franchise by being a successful winning engine. Those days are gone. This is not baseball or Saudi soccer. You cannot just throw money at the wall and hope that it sticks anymore, because that can set you up for a decade plus of guaranteed failure. Take a team like the Phoenix Suns, for example. If 5 years from now, we look back at the Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, Chris Paul, Bradley Beal, DeAndre Ayton experiment, and we say, well, they didn't end up winning a ring, but at least they were competitive, that can still be classified as a failure. Because you went all in. You gave away everything. You have no picks, assuming that your swaps end up registering, because 4 years from now, the likelihood of you still being a contender are rather slim, even though you may still have some youth within Ayton and Booker. It's likely at that point Kevin Durant is no longer an all-star caliber player, and I'd be willing to bet Bradley Beal is probably in the same boat. If they don't win a ring with this core, regardless of what upcoming moves and changes they may make, it would ultimately be deemed nothing but a failure. If they're competitive for the next 5 seasons, but then fall off a cliff afterwards, they have completely renounced the entire rights to any sort of future capability of building through the most valuable asset for a team looking to rebuild, and that's draft picks. They are devoid. These CBA changes are massive, and they put real hampering effects on any team that decides to approach and exceed that second apron figure. That being said, let's talk about how these teams factor into the practical cap. Now, I will mention, my figures are going to be coming from SpotTrack. Depending on where you're going, these projection numbers are going to change. Sometimes by tens of millions of dollars at an overall figure. It is important to keep in mind that this is merely a projected figure until we see that bill come October with that finalized roster. But for now, this is the closest that we're going to get to a hard rounding figure. The team that has the largest payroll in the NBA is the Golden State Warriors, whose total cap is listed $249 million. They have negative $113 million of cap space. Even if they were to go into what's considered the super tax space, which is that second apron figure, they would only have $1.7 million of wiggle room with the way the roster is presently set. At number two would be the Los Angeles Clippers. They're hovering around $228 million in total cap, with super tax practical space of negative $21 million. Third is the Milwaukee Bucks with a total cap payroll of $227 million. Fourth is the Los Angeles Lakers with a projected total cap of $223 million. And fifth is the Portland Trailblazers with a total projected cap of $218 million. There is borderline no room for error within those franchises and their respective upcoming decisions, both regarding potential trades, future assets, and any upcoming free agent signings. These teams have almost no space to create outside of what the present roster is. It would require a lot of brain work in renouncing rights to several players, making savvy around-the-edges deals where, similarly to what the Sacramento Kings just did on draft day, shipping off Rashawn Holmes to then open up $25 million in cap, you would have to make cutting corners moves of that degree. And for teams like the Lakers or the Clippers, you just don't have the requisite talent to give up pieces and chunks of your playable roster at will. As far as teams go with the most cap space, well, that's something that you're going to see a lot of youth in this range. Number one would be the Houston Rockets with $60.9 million. Second would be the San Antonio Spurs with $38.6 million. Third, the Sacramento Kings, the aforementioned, at $35.6 million following that Rashawn Holmes trade. At fourth, the Indiana Pacers with $32.2 million. Fifth, the Detroit Pistons with $30 million. Sixth, the Utah Jazz with $28.4 million. Seventh, the Orlando Magic with $23.9 million. And eighth, the Oklahoma City Thunder with $16.6 million. According to the numbers that I have in front of me, those are the only teams that would have roughly $15 million or more of practical, usable cap space, therefore making those teams the most likely to be able to find a player worth using that on in this free agent market. Typically, the going rate for a good starting NBA player is right around the $15 to $25 million range. Take a Tyler Hero, Jordan Poole, Anthony Simons, for example. I do expect this upcoming CBA to be the bearer of bad news for that sort of middle class of NBA player. Because if part of the game is now taking into serious consideration what you can spend and who you can spend it on, as opposed to, well, I guess we'll just go on the tax again if that means another ring, you're going to have to be resetting the average value of that mid and lower tier player just to be even able to sign them. Because let me tell you right now, nobody's going to pay $20 million for Bruce Brown. Despite, in comparison to some of the other contracts in the NBA, that might be where he's worth. But when only seven teams even have the available space to take on a player at that money, there isn't going to be a wide range of outcomes, and there certainly isn't going to be a lot of interest. And what do we know about supply and demand? In this case, there's a very limited supply. There's roughly 550 full and two-way players in the NBA. How many of those guys make in excess of $20 million? It's not every starter. But with the way things have trended following the last few TV deals since roughly 2013, players that were previously worth single-digit million dollars, players that you wouldn't even consider signing on a mid-level, were earning the high teens, the low 20s. You even had guys signed to contracts at the dawning stages of their careers, such as a Kevin Love, just because teams had to give the money to somebody in order to avoid not using it and paying a penalty fee for that, just so that down the line they would have that contract as a tradable asset, which obviously did not work out for them as they ended up waiving him, but neither here nor there. The point being, overpay no longer exists. And most of the players in the NBA who are going to be up for new contracts in the next 2 to 3 years are unfortunately going to be part of a system that requires them to be underpaid for what should be the actual value of an NBA player to be reset to a normality. Sometimes extreme exposures in the market allow us to see vulnerabilities of the way that those markets may work. And these players just so happen to cross paths and become the martyrs of the salary cap dumping. As far as the actual player free agents go, and not just numbers, ranking them in an order, top to bottom, we would likely have to go James Harden, Kyrie Irving, Chris Middleton, Draymond Green, Fred VanVleet. And then if we're talking about guys that are available but may not be stars, but rather glue guys, parts of a franchise who are going to push you towards winning, but are not the underlying reason as to why, you have guys like Gabe Vincent, Bruce Brown, Max Strus, Josh Hart, Caris LeVert, Seth Curry, Jeremy Grant, Kyle Kuzma, Harrison Barnes, Christian Wood, Trey Lyles, Jakob Poeltl. All of these players are important in their own right. And I separated them from the rest of the pack because those are the guys that are unrestricted, i.e. going to garner the most interest. One of the most overassumed things about the NBA free agency market is that restricted contracts are something that teams are willing to bid on to mess with another owner. It's just bad business practice, if you think about it in a nutshell. Yes, as a fan, would it be awesome to know that there's a team placing a bid on a player that's on the open market from a rival team and driving up that price like an auctioneer? Of course, that would be super fun if we got that leak. Unfortunately, you're messing with people's lives, messing with people's money, their income, their ability to support their family. You're playing with agents, promises, and ultimately, it just is not a good look to be in the business of bringing up prices with no intention of ever going after that player. Whispering in the open market about unrestricted free agents definitely can rise the price of a player. And that's something that is not scoffed at, that is definitely done by numerous GMs. Because with an unrestricted player, it's more like a flirting type of situation. You're not courting, you're just checking out what's up. So it is not uncommon for a restricted free agent to end up having a significantly lower interest in the open market than a player that wouldn't carry that baggage may have. We're going to get to the restricted guys in just a second, but I want to talk about the unrestricted batch first, starting with James Harden. James Harden is a former NBA MVP who needs no introduction. We all know about the playoff woes. We know about the forced entry, disentry, I don't know what you would call it, forced outing of the previous franchises that he's been at, becoming a pariah of sorts within the league. And let's be real, he's about to be 34 years old. The health has dwindled the previous few seasons, as well as the conditioning. And despite a few really crazy, like truly incredible playoff performances this past run, he still was not able to consistently get over the hump and has just proven to us time and time again that he is better suited as the third option primary ball handler on a team than he is the second scoring option if you want to win an NBA championship. However, despite all that, he's one of the best shot makers in the NBA. He's somebody who, before these last two seasons of injury, was seen as an Iron Man of sorts. He would always play big minutes and the majority of games in a season. And he's one of the most creative and best passers to ever play the game of basketball. So there's not going to be a single team who is in need of an offensive playmaker that isn't going to be throwing money at James Harden. We all heard the stories all season about going back to Houston, becoming the franchise idol, somebody that they look up to and idolize the same way that they may have Hakeem in the past. And I can see the logic in a place that you came to love in close to a decade, where your best moments were kind of like a thinking back on high school type of situation. But all news for the last 3 weeks, at a minimum, has pointed towards Harden going back to the Philadelphia 76ers, returning for another hoorah run with Joel Embiid and new fan favorite Tobias Harris. And that's the move that, truthfully, he has to make at this point in his career, because it would be pure cowardice if he were to turn around and head south again. Taking the comfortable route is not something that's going to be lauded by NBA fans, media, and former players. And giving up on a challenge would be not only cowardly, but just downright disrespectful to the game of basketball that has given a player like James Harden so much. I really do hope that he goes back to Philadelphia, because I do think that there are remnants of what could be a perfect team of sorts. There's not a single statistical analysis that you can point to of the pick and roll combination of James Harden and Joel Embiid that no team wouldn't be worried about. If they get hot for just 4 of 7 games, there is an argument if James Harden is a Philadelphia 76er. And if he's not, I'm sorry. That argument goes out the window. And another thing important to note with Harden is that there was an assumed perspective that Houston may offer him more money than what Philadelphia can due to their ability of that $60 million in cap. And although the figures may not necessarily look the same at first glance, Harden has the ability to extend on his present contract, digging into the cap as much as he would like to. And Philadelphia has the ability to basically offer him the exact same dollar figure as what Houston can, but for a longer term. If you're James Harden, approaching your mid-30s, as somebody who has given up in the past and really let things loose, you want to take the deal with longer accrued value, because if you're getting paid out longer, that's a success. We've heard Wendy say it. There's no other team for James Harden than the Philadelphia 76ers. And his former co-star, Kyrie Irving, is in a similar predicament. He was also part of the failed bomb experiment in Brooklyn that went sideways in more ways than one, mostly due to his behavior and irrational mindset. The biggest thing with Kyrie Irving has never been his talent. He is one of the most skilled players to ever pick up a basketball. He's the best dribbler the NBA has ever seen. He makes the toughest shots the NBA has ever seen. And everything looks pristine and crisp as if he was programmed to do it in a lab. I'm sure that would be a supporting theory of Kyrie Irving somewhere in the deep space, but that's the problem, is the deep space. It started with the flat earth shit and questioning LeBron. Then it snowballed. It became a mandated vaccine. It became being ineligible to work because of stubbornness. And then it became, well, propaganda. Somehow he ended up in Dallas as a co-star to Luka, and offensively they kind of made it work. You can go look at the numbers. Even though they may not have been the most winning tandem in NBA history, they certainly did have multiple onslaught and flurry type of scoring offensive output games. And I do think that there is some logic in putting together two players with that type of ceiling, that type of clutch gene, and that type of shot-making ability, and just hoping for the best. Because the alternative is letting somebody who is 24 years old, viewed for years as the next heir to the throne, somebody who has been a borderline MVP favorite since he was 21, go for nothing. Simply because you mismanaged and did not properly take care of your assets, both in properly scouting and retaining the correct pieces alongside Luka. So the alternative to not bringing back Kyrie Irving is not a route that any franchise would elect to go. The hard part with Kyrie is not bringing him back, it's how much for, because he too is in his 30s. And the availability is a bigger question than with any other player in the NBA, despite by all accounts being somebody who is a great teammate and is beloved within locker rooms by the team because of his ability to seamlessly fit in with other players. He's a guy's guy. He's somebody that when you watch play basketball, you are just in absolute awe of. You're jealous. You wish you could play the way Kyrie Irving does. And you can't fathom how somebody with that level of ability can be so far gone from time to time. And that's why Kyrie Irving is not going to be getting the same type of deal as what James Harden will, where it's near max money for a 4 or 5 year term. More than likely, Kyrie Irving is going to end up in the $30 to $35 million range for 2 seasons, and I could see slightly above with a trade kicker of sorts, but the last thing that you want to do if you're Dallas is invest the full max, the rest of what you can, into a player that you can't promise is going to get you over the hump because he hasn't shown the ability to even put his foot in the door enough to give you the chance. Chris Middleton is certainly a weird case and somebody who has kind of been thought of as off to the side in a way, just simply because the initial reporting surrounding him declining the extension and opting in, rather opting out, was simply to secure a longer contract due to his recent string of injuries, the increasing number of age, and the likelihood that within a few seasons, the Chris Middleton experience is going to come to an end. So getting paid for longer with less money is not only a better look for you publicly because you are assisting the team within the building perspective, you are also getting yourself a longer payday. But how can we be so certain that Chris Middleton is going to still remain a Milwaukee Buck? They have to bring back Brook Lopez. And they have several other guys who were viewed as important constructional pieces of the roster, integral cornerstone pieces, guys that they brought in with aspirations to go back to the NBA Finals for the first time in two seasons. And we got to be honest, the majority of them didn't underperform in a Milwaukee uniform. I do think Chris Middleton is an important player to the city of Milwaukee for everything that he's done. But I also think the proof is generally in the pudding. And outside of a handful of high usage, high attempt games last season, he was pretty eh. There were a lot of games he wouldn't get to the free throw line. If the shot wasn't falling, he was basically a zero offensively. And the injuries have not rendered him useless on defense, but he certainly isn't somebody who is a good defender by any stretch of the imagination anymore. If he's not hitting shots, what can he do for you if you are the Milwaukee Bucks? And there's a lot of guys who don't require $40 million or a four-year investment who can also hit shots for you, that you have the ability to go out and get simply because you employ Giannis Antetokounmpo and a ownership group that is willing to make the proper moves and sacrifices to bring championship pedigree and requisite talent into the franchise despite the questionable coaching and untimely injuries that they've suffered in the last few seasons. I just don't know how you can bring back Chris Middleton anywhere near that money and think that you're still really in the running as an Eastern contender. Because if that's the only move that you have is bringing back what you did last year, look how that ended for you. And I'm not saying they would lose to the Heat again. I think if we played that series 10 times over, the Bucks would probably win the majority of them. But the Bucks were one of the best teams in the NBA, and the Heat, the entire season, were not. So unless they were doing some Jedi mind trick, let's just save everybody rotationally for the playoffs and make sure the guys are getting their rest, which is very, very un-Miami Heat culture-like. The Bucks should be winning that series 9 times out of 10 with that roster if you are investing in those pieces. And the fact that they didn't even come close is the most worrying factor about bringing back Chris Middleton, because all that would signify, if it's around that same money, is that you have no hope for better, that this is who you're riding with, and that ride has been relatively bumpy besides one season up to this point. And in a similar facet, you have a player like Draymond Green, somebody who is also in their 30s, part of a previous championship roster of recent history, and a key member, beloved figure in that local community for all they've done for that franchise in their decade with that team. With Draymond Green, there's a little bit more of an accepted ignorance than there is for, say, a Chris Middleton type of player. Because at the end of the day, Draymond has been part of several finals runs, multiple championships, multiple all-defensive teams. He's outspoken. He's somebody that's garnered national media attention. And when you think Warriors, it's hard not to think Draymond Green almost immediately following Steph Curry, for at least the last five seasons. I think that even though there are teams that may have the money and interest in these two players, even though I think that it is going to be overpay at the end of the day, if you are exceeding $30 million for either, if you're in that $30 million range, why not bring him back? I know. It sounds like what I just said was, why would you pay Chris Middleton and Draymond Green all of that money? Simply because for teams that are so hampered by this upcoming CBA, the cap regulations, just an unfortunate timing sort of situation, you don't really have many other moves available. Because if you let the assets walk for nothing, you now have nothing. And even bringing them back on slightly overpaid contracts is unfortunately just the way that the NBA sometimes conducts business, especially for guys that may not end up having statues, but are definitely never going to have to buy a drink again in that city. If Draymond Green and Chris Middleton are not a Golden State Warrior and Milwaukee Buck, respectively, come mid-October, I would be very surprised. We also have to talk about Fred VanVleet, aka Federico. The thing with Fred VanVleet is there's never been a time where you've looked at his game or him as a player and said, yeah, I'd like to give this guy $40 million. But for a team like the Houston Rockets, because he is somebody who is not in his mid-30s and has been part of a championship team that recently has had some struggles outside of Fred VanVleet's personal attachment and capabilities, it would be very easy for a franchise to look at Federico and say, I can understand investing in this asset. And if it doesn't pan out, it's somebody who likely will still have the ability to garner at least some return at the end of that contract instead of requiring a buyout or a restructure into the dead cap. Houston is somebody who, well, some team, I should say, that has been very interested in bringing Fred VanVleet and acquiring his services. And I gotta say, I would agree with spending the $40 million there. Because there aren't many players in this class of free agents that you could make the argument are all-stars in their own right. And I wouldn't have made it the last two seasons. But Fred VanVleet is somebody who borders and teeters that all-star line. If you bring a guy with that type of vet savvy and pedigree into that locker room, that's likely the best option for the youth surrounding, and also puts you in a position where you can afford to give a player that deserves the keys to the car those keys, while also giving them the ability to be mentored by somebody who has won a championship, has played alongside some of the best players to ever play, and has seen years of NBA offenses evolving, NBA coach schemes changing, and the diversification of plays and play styles. And that's something that for a franchise like Houston, who has basically lacked that since Chris Paul and James Harden, there's no reason to pass up on that just because you want to scoff at a few million dollars. You have to use the money in some way, shape, or form. Why not use it on Big Freddy V? All right, quick hitter for this one. I can't believe that I didn't mention any of these former All-Stars. Brooke Lopez, Russell Westbrook, D'Angelo Russell, Kevin Love, Derrick Rose, Victor Oladipo, Blake Griffin, and DeAndre Jordan. Let's be real. The majority of those guys aren't going to be getting significant NBA minutes next season. Probably outside of Brooke Lopez, Russell Westbrook, and D'Angelo Russell, There may be one dark horse candidate out of the remaining ones that is going to actually play meaningful, impactful NBA minutes. And I wouldn't blame you if you question my inclusion of Russell Westbrook in that statement. I think Brook Lopez is very clearly the most valuable player from that list. And I know the Houston buzz has been enormous, but I just don't see how Milwaukee does not find a way to bring him back, knowing how important he is to that franchise. If Brook has other plans, if he, because he's already won it, because he's already been an all-star, because he does have that argument as the greatest thing to ever be a part of the Nets franchise, I can see why you may want that big payday at the end. I just don't truly believe that there's a team out there willing to give him $15+ million a season at age 35, knowing where his brother is at in his respective career after numerous back procedures in the last half decade. As far as Westbrook goes, he makes sense on pretty much any team that does not know where they're going. A team that's just kind of permanently banned to that purgatorial middle. You could also see like a reunion tour with, say, the Washington Wizards, although I don't know how they would ever share the ball between Poole and Russell Westbrook. It may just be a shoot-off every single game, which I'm also down for. But like a Chicago would be the perfect destination for Westbrook, a market where it's big enough where the spotlight is still on him, wide enough where he has the ability to make mistakes because he's not going to be questioned on national television because the Bulls fucking suck. And he's also in a place that direly needs a dominant force that fans can get behind, which is something that somehow, at every stop of the way, besides the Los Angeles Lakers, Russell Westbrook finds a way to do. He becomes beloved. Even if his play may be irresponsible, his decision-making irrational, he still is somebody that you look at the name on the jersey and you understand why he's wearing it. D'Angelo Russell is going to end up being a litmus test for who watches basketball and who doesn't with their reaction to how much he gets paid in this upcoming market. If you told me D'Angelo Russell got a 2-year, $20 million contract, I would say, okay, that makes a lot of sense. He had some struggles. If you told me he got a 2-year, $45 million contract, I'd be like, okay. He hit a lot of shots. I mean, he had a crazy shooting clip percentage last season. And unfortunately, D'Angelo Russell as the player kind of lies somewhere in between those two. He's not somebody who every single game is going to make costly decisions, take over offensive possessions when he has no clear direction on what he's supposed to be doing, shoot ill-advised shots at terrible times in the shot clock, whether that be very early or holding the ball till very late. Dumb turnovers, forced errors. He also is not somebody who is going to be getting you 35 points a night and making highlight reel plays and shooting and making 6 3-point shots. D'Angelo Russell as an idea makes a lot of sense to come back to the Lakers, but ultimately it comes down to how bad does he want it? Because if he's just going to stay in this facet of player, continue his career as somebody who is fine never changing, despite what may be around him, more power to him. That's his own selfish decision. But at the end of the day, that's not what's going to get him paid. I don't see how any team shells out significant dollars for somebody who has proven time and time again that he is not up to par for taking that challenge, and consistently will back down from anything that is too aggressive, too difficult, too much thinking. The talent is there. The ability has never been the question. It's always been the mindset. And unfortunately, the mindset is what's going to hurt his payday in this upcoming market. For the next tier of players, those glue guys that are very important and valuable to a championship team, but may also have the ability to earn $15 million contracts at other stops of the way too. I'm talking about that Gabe Vincent, Bruce Brown, Jeremy Grant, Harrison Barnes type of area. I'm not going to go through every single listed option here, just the ones that I feel are valuable or most valuable. Look, Gabe Vincent averaged 15-4 per 36 in the playoffs before he got hurt against the Celtics. That's somebody who the return on investment is through the absolute ceiling. And he was a big bucket maker that entire playoff run. Any team that watched the Miami Heat in the playoffs, and let me tell you an insider secret, there was a lot, wouldn't mind throwing the bag at Gabe Vincent. I could see him making roughly around $15 million. I wouldn't be surprised if Bruce Brown comes in at about the same price range. Bruce Brown, for the last few seasons, has been somebody that has shown that he is willing to adapt to whatever role the coach is going to be giving him. He takes what's given. He doesn't question a lot of things. And he's a hard-nosed, head-down type of guy. Any franchise would love a professional of that nature, especially after the dominance that he showed. Interpositionally switching. Hustling. Basically flying up and down the court as the sole transitional defensive option for the Denver Nuggets most of that playoff run. I could understand if he goes back to Denver on a shorter contract worth a little bit more money, but I also could understand if he gets that 15 mil from a team that is in dire need of a big, smart veteran presence. And I'd be happy for Bruce Brown either way, because if he goes back to the Nuggets, there's a world where he's a repeat champion. And if he gets paid elsewhere, it's been multiple years in the making. I also want to talk about Max Strus and Josh Hart here. Max Strus was somebody in the playoffs who maybe didn't reach that caliber of shot making that a Gabe Vincent did, but he was a dangerous option. And similarly to when I talked about Jordan Hawkins in my NBA draft coverage, even if there's severe defensive and liability-laden ball handling incapability from that type of a shooter, there's just not a lot of teams that you would be able to get a clear answer on them not being interested in a guy that can shoot the lights out of the ball like a Max Strus can. And basically any team that's looking for backcourt depth with the ability of a quick trigger is going to be willing to reach into their pockets around the 10 mil range to go after a Max Strus. I think Dennis Schroeder is also pretty important to talk about here, because if he goes back to the Lakers, he's shown that he can be a valuable asset on that team. But when he's been elsewhere, he's very hit or miss, and somebody who can either be a fan favorite or absolutely outcasted by the people of his city, his respective franchise. And I don't really know what to do with that information other than hope that he goes back to LA, because he seems to be at his best playing alongside LeBron and AD. But if he goes somewhere else and, you know, he plays to a similar degree, is as consistent of a shooter as he was in LA, I also wouldn't be surprised. I just hope it's not one of those cap space teams that has all that youth, because that's the exact anti-opposite of what you would want to bring in for that respective culture. And sorry we're jumping around here. I know I forgot about Josh Hart there, but as a Knicks fan, Josh Hart was somebody who was easily ingestible for me. I don't know how many pictures I retweeted of those New York braids. Josh Hart's cool, man. And he's a really genuinely good guy. I've listened to him on podcasts, great interviewer, somebody that is going to take the time to really put in the effort into studying and understanding what is asked of him. I do just want to mention, I would be a little cautious as far as really throwing the bag at Josh Hart as if he was somebody that is a significant everyday starter level contributor, because I do think he showed down the stretch, especially in the playoff run, that he does have some tendencies to be a little unreliable at times. And if there's a offensive guy who has just a little bit of muscle and size on him, he may be able to switch onto, say, a small power forward, but those big guys really give him trouble. And small, quick guys kind of can get around him too. He has the wings on lock, and again, I love the guy to death. I just would be a little scared if you're a team that's truly considering giving him close to that $15 million a year range. Jeremy Grant's also a pretty tough one to analyze, simply because the differing stages of where Jeremy Grant has been at in his career have not necessarily corresponded with what we expected of his level of talent. In Denver, he was somebody who never really got the opportunities that he was hoping for. In Detroit, he seemed to have gotten too many. He was taking almost 21 shots a game as a Detroit Piston. And with Portland, it seems to be more in that just right type of sphere. Somebody who, if you put up the Venn diagram of this wasn't working and this was kind of working, he's now somewhere in that direct cross middle, right where he should be. I do think he's worth a significant penny in this market. He is one of the better unrestricted players. I would even go as far as arguing that he's somebody who should be top five average net value contractually of this class. I do see a world where he goes right back to Portland seamlessly, but I also wouldn't be surprised as somebody who's changed scenery often and not necessarily been somebody who's beloved as a teammate, stop to stop. I could see him going elsewhere on a similar contract and being a similar contributor to what he already has been in his career. If you're a team that needs a positionless wing with size that can play guard 3-4, and you have the money, I could definitely see and understand why you would want to give it to Jeremy Grant. Kyle Kuzma, similar camp, a little bit less money. I like Kuz a lot. He partially has inspired an idea within me to want to dye my own hair upon buzzing it. Although I don't know if I could really pull off the Slim Shady pink uniform type of situation, but I certainly can try. Kuz is a little bit older than people tend to give him credit for. Remember, he came in pretty late when he was a rookie. But he's still proven, both with the Lakers and now with the Wizards, that he does deserve a consistent look as an every night starter that should shoot somewhere between 12 and 15 shots a game. And that's just kind of the mama bear, papa bear, just right type of situation for Kuz. He's not as good defensively as Jeremy Grant is. He's not as good of a individual source of offense as Jeremy Grant is. He may make up a little bit as far as the rebounding department goes, but I do think just from the optics of how Kyle Kuzma is and how little he's contributed to winning with the Washington Wizards most recently, you kind of just have to give him a little bit lesser of a contract. Speaking of guys who may not be getting any lesser of a contract, we have Dylan Brooks. I didn't want to discuss this. I don't like Dylan Brooks. Don't like his play style. Don't like what he stands for. I think he is very overrated in both his own eyes as well as the eyes of basketball teams, simply because he shoots 14 shots a game. And he's somebody who should maybe be shooting 4 shots a game. I understand, if you want to be involved and locked in defensively as an elite defender, you also want to touch the ball on offense. Nobody wants to be the scrappy guy in hustle that just pokes the ball away from everybody else, but then bricks every jumper that he takes. I get it. But at the end of the day, if you're in a position where you are competing in the playoffs, and your mindset is to openly attack the opponent when you personally cannot do anything offensively to contribute towards your team's ability to win that game, you just have to kind of have a reality check of sorts. And I do think that public dismissal, that humiliation of the Grizzlies openly stating that they will not bring Dylan Brooks back under any circumstance, is exactly what a player like that needed to pick his career up from the depths, understand that maybe he should be shooting the ball significantly less than he ever was. And if he just buys into the PJ Tucker role, he is a year-by-year all-defensive nod. And any team would be willing to take on a year-by-year all-defensive wing, because every team needs wing defense. The number one report is that he's going to end up a Houston Rocket. If they end up bringing in Dylan Brooks and Fred VanVleet along with their present core, that's something that would definitely be meaningful for both the city of Houston, as well as something that other teams are going to keep their eyes on and monitor closely. Because there's a world where that lineup, if given enough time, if given the proper training and mechanics, if pulled into the light of becoming a professional franchise yet again, has the talent to be a serious force for at least a small window in a couple years. And then we've got Jakob Poeltl. Jakob Poeltl is a weird case because he's pretty much only played for 2 franchises back and forth cumulatively. I like Jakob Poeltl. We know what he does. And I don't think that's ever going to change. I don't think you can really hope for more from somebody who plays like a Jakob Poeltl. You just kind of have to throw him out there, watch him get rebounds, stuff a couple shots at the rim, get torched every now and then by guys that are a little bit heftier than him, and try to keep him away from putting the ball on the floor. I think there is still somewhat of a need for that in modern basketball. I just don't think paying somebody who has shown us what his peak already is significant money, unless you're the Raptors just trying to salvage the asset that you traded for. I don't see how that is proper process as far as roster building strategy would go. And now into the restrictions. We would have Austin Reeves and Rui Hachimura, both of the Los Angeles Lakers. I do see a world where the Lakers renounce the rights to Rui Hachimura. And I know that's something that may be a little bit goofy to think about as an endover move if you're discussing how that process of Rui Hachimura as a Laker went front to back. It'd be really stupid in a nutshell to say, hey, we traded for this guy to get 15 usable games out of him and then just gone with the wind. But with them being so backed up against the wall as far as their money situation goes, and with how flawed Rui Hachimura seemed to be after the first few games where he performed at a rate unlike he did ever in his career with the Wizards, we just seem to know what Rui Hachimura is made of and made for, and I don't think it's Laker basketball. But I do think that would be the case for an Austin Reeves. Reeves is somebody who's also been rumored to Houston as well as San Antonio, if reporting is credible. And both those teams have the money to bring in a player like Austin Reeves. Where you start to lose me is if Austin Reeves genuinely enjoys the attention and celebrity and winning basketball that he has become a part of, that he has become a household name because of, going to either of those franchises, even if you love Wemby, is likely not the best career decision for a player who had the chance taken on him. Generally, we would see this in a situation with a player like the aforementioned Cam Reddish, who was unhappy in his situation and wanted to go. I don't think Austin Reeves wants to leave LA. And even though there's no significant ties there where I wouldn't be surprised if he took some money elsewhere, if he's anything like the way that he seems to present himself in interviews and publicly, I just don't know how you turn down that Lakers job. Likely the biggest restricted free agent is Cam Johnson of the Brooklyn Nets. Cam Johnson is an interesting case of a player who we may not have seen the peaks of, and he has shown an ability to be a very consistent scorer and knockdown shooter. I do think the age is a little bit of a factor, considering he is 27 years old. He also missed a significant portion of time with a pretty horrendous injury last season. Well, going into last season, I should say, at least it was a lingering injury. But I like Cam Johnson, and I understand giving him a significant dollar valuation around the $30 million mark, $25 million mark, simply because he's a proven talent. He's worked for everywhere he's ever fit at. He made perfect sense in Houston. He made perfect sense with the Nets. And despite some limited ball handling ability and defensive upside, I do think that the requisite length and shooting is something that would propel him to get a little bit more attention from the pocketbooks of other franchises. And the rumor's pretty much consistently been that Detroit has been the team that's been all in on Cam Johnson. If they give him that full 30, why wouldn't he take it? It's what he's worth. Grant Williams is also restricted. I'm somebody who's of the belief that Grant Williams is a winning player, but I don't believe that he's somebody who can necessarily be an everyday part of an 8-man playoff rotation. He has some very significant fatal flaws when it comes to his mentality and way that he approaches both playing basketball and being a public figure. I do like the confidence and self-trust in his abilities, because as an NBA player, you always want to think you're the best NBA player. Otherwise, what are you doing in a league against the best? If you don't have that competitive drive to push yourself to be great, you won't be. Not in this league. So I don't think you can give up on a player like Grant Williams just because he's had a little bit of a roller coaster in terms of overall production. But I do think that paying him significant money, which I would say is anything in excess of the $13 million, $12 million mid-level exception, would just not be the proper way to go about building your franchise, especially since we're not certain, like I said, if he truly can be part of an everyday 8-man playoff rotation. We also have PJ Washington, aka Mr. Renner. I like PJ Washington. He's been somebody who his entire time in Charlotte has been that guy where if you're watching the Charlotte Hornets, and I wouldn't blame you if you haven't been, but if you're watching the Charlotte Hornets, you point at your screen and you go, whoa, that guy's actually pretty freaking good. Who's number 25? Turns out, it's PJ Washington. He is a good player. He routinely makes the right plays. He's unselfish. He can be somebody who is switchable and can score from numerous angles. He truly is an underrated player. I just think that he has unfortunately fell victim to a culture that has not allowed him to progress and develop his game in the way that you would like to see for a contending team. And if the money's not there from a contending team, I don't see any reason why he just doesn't pack his things up and stay in Charlotte. Well, unpack his things back in Charlotte, I guess, would be the proper. Either way, point being, PJ Washington staying a Hornet would be the most logical course of action here. And it's hard to really predict what type of money he gets. I would say similar in that mid-level area. But certainly could understand based on the youth if he were to get slightly more. Especially when you consider that youth alongside the relatively consistent and upside-driven production. Other restricted guys that we talked about: Io DeSunmu, Kobe White, Matisse Thybulle, Jackson Hayes, B-Ball Paul, Jock Landale, Naw, a.k.a. Nickeil Alexander-Walker, and Cam Reddish. I don't see either of the last two really getting any significant money. Jock Landale, I could definitely see going just right back to the Suns. I don't know why they just wouldn't match him. B-Ball Paul probably deserves more than what he's gotten so far, but has proven to us last playoffs that he may also be somebody who cannot be defined as part of an eight-man playoff rotation. Jackson Hayes is just kind of a shoulder shrug. We don't really know what he is. I've never really known what he is. He seems like a Jericho Sims, but somewhat more playable. Maybe a little bit worse off the court. It's hard to really gauge Jackson Hayes' value because, genuinely, he hasn't done much since entering the NBA. Matisse Thybulle played pretty okay for the Trailblazers last season, started to make some three-pointers near the end of the season, which was something that he really never did for the 76ers in the last few seasons. He's a questionable asset, to say the least. Great defender, but really is just never going to have that ability to be a source of offense consistently, and you may find some problems playing him alongside other players that struggle with the ball in their hands, meaning you may have a lineup logjam forcing him to play around the 15-minute mark every single game, no more. So I could certainly see why Matisse Thybulle may not have an ideal landing space coming out of this free agency period. Io DeSunmu is pretty much the only other guy who I think should be getting a little bit of a bump from what he was previously making, just because very unselfish, very driven, very focused type of player. Just carries himself in a way that you could see him as a member of the back of a bench of a championship team, even if he may not necessarily be contributing. So I do think he warrants a little bit of a pay increase, but certainly could see if other teams may not agree with my analysis of that situation. We're going to end this podcast with me trying to predict the landing spots for each of these free agents, or the majority of them that we've just discussed. I think Austin Reeves is ultimately going to be re-signed through that restricted market by the Lakers. I don't see a world in which they just don't match whatever offer sheet comes his way, even if it is going to end up being a poison pill type of contract where they're paying him double what he's worth in that final season, just to shed some off the books now. I don't see why you would, if you're the Lakers, lose the asset for nothing, or even come close to risking that. Similarly to what the Suns did last season with DeAndre Ayton, you have to eat the baggage if you're this desperate. Brook Lopez, I believe, is going to be re-signed by the Bucks on a small and short contract that promptly sees his way out along the same timeline as Jrue Holiday, who publicly announced he's likely going to be retiring after the next two seasons. Bruce Brown is going to opt out of his player option. I do believe he ends up back with the Nuggets, simply because he's always struck me as the type of guy who, just from the unselfish nature of his play, is willing to sacrifice if it means meaning more as part of a franchise and team identity where you are revered as that guy that helped you get that ring. That bench guy who will never be forgotten. That guy that people in bars in Denver talk about 30 years from now, when before this season, they might not have known your name. I don't know how much he goes back for, but I do think he goes right back to the Mile High. Cam Johnson. Look, we know the Pistons are going to give him the money. The question is, are the Nets willing to match that offer sheet? I would say why not. If I'm the Brooklyn Nets, I would say why not. I mortgaged my greatest asset at a time I didn't have to, in a methodology where the extracted assets ended up being a significant package return, but didn't necessarily leave you with many outlets to move on from Kevin Durant simply because of his request to land with the Suns. And after just half a season, you can't just let Cam Johnson walk. Not if you're me. D'Angelo Russell, I do believe, is somebody who, despite everybody's hope that he goes somewhere else, is just going to end up back with the Lakers, simply because the Lakers need assets. If they hope to do anything at all this upcoming season, they need people who can play basketball. And despite the flaws, despite the struggles, complications, headaches, and my audible gasps when watching some of the things that he does on a basketball court, I just don't think if you're the Lakers, you can afford to let anybody walk for nothing at this stage that played crucial playoff minutes for you this past season. Draymond Green already declined his option. There is a little bit of a rumor that he may go to the Kings, but I do think that the Chris Paul deal kind of sealed it. Getting rid of the Jordan Poole asset, both personally for Draymond Green as well as from a team-building perspective, likely puts Draymond in the mindset of thinking that the Warriors are making the proper decisions to anchor the franchise for further success, hopefully. And so I do believe because they can offer him near $30 million, that there's no reason for Draymond, at this stage of his career, to try to go elsewhere and propel a different team into the contention path while foregoing everything he's ever known as an NBA player. Dylan Brooks, I believe, ends up going to the Houston Rockets alongside Fred VanVleet, like I discussed earlier. And I do think that's a move that, like I mentioned, I would be very much in support of. Because I do think both players offer better defense than they're given credit for. And I also think that Jalen Green has significant untapped potential that when you put other guys who have the ability to put the ball in the basket, like Fred VanVleet, around him, take some of the pressure off of teams individually keying on one guy besides big Alpi Shangoon down in the post. And at the end of the day, if they have eight guys who I can look at top to bottom on a roster and say, oh, I like him, how could they not at least be frisky? Grant Williams, I believe, is the player that ends up on the Sacramento Kings simply because they're not going to be able to hit that home run ball with Draymond Green, and they're going to opt to go a different route in bringing in a similar player because they are going to need the wing depth, losing Harrison Barnes. And Grant Williams is going to end up providing that defensive prowess that they're going to end up needing within the future movements of this franchise and hopeful return to where they were presently located in the standings this past season. Jakob Poeltl, I think, ends up going to the OKC Thunder. I know they just traded for Davis Bertans. I know they have Chet Holmgren and Alexei Pokuševski. Jakob Poeltl is somebody who is not going to garner the contract that most teams are going to think he's worth. And at the end of the day, just feels like the type of guy where when you look at where he'll likely be money-wise following this free agency window closing, I just don't know how you can give that guy lots of money. And if you're OKC, you're just hoping to bring in any form of talent that can play alongside guys that are making significant strides. Hopefully guys that don't need the ball. hopefully guys that can mentor a Chet Holmgren into being the proper type of NBA big as far as rebounding, defensive impact, and selflessness goes. And if they have the money, why not? I think James Harden obviously ends up going back to the Philadelphia 76ers, along with Kyrie Irving going back to the Dallas Mavericks. I know, boring picks so far. Jeremy Grant going back to the Portland Trail Blazers. If you're the Blazers, you can't afford, after investing the pick in Scoot, to lose any more value as a franchise, even if you do end up trading Dame, simply because Jeremy Grant, in a nutshell, at this point, is probably your second best player until the obvious rise of Shadon Sharpe and Scoot Henderson. And I just don't think that a guy like that, even though he may be attractive in other team facilities and roster builds, he just fits in that Trailblazer lineup rather seamlessly in a way that not retaining that asset would not only be detrimental to the Blazers franchise, but also to the relationship that is already somewhat faltered with Damian Lillard. Josh Hart, I believe, ends up back with the Knicks simply because, you know, you can't just ever be in a stop with your best friend for that small amount of time. He loves it there. Seems like the type of guy who's willing to take a pay cut similar to Bruce Brown just to be a part of something that he genuinely loves on a winning basketball team. And that's what the Knicks can provide. Yo, KD! Don't you regret not coming to the Knicks! I had to do it. Chris Middleton ends up going back to the Milwaukee Bucks. Kyle Kuzma is where things get tough. I had him written down as the player that the Utah Jazz should end up going after. And then obviously following the John Collins trade, that was something that, well, I had to end up changing because they have no reason now to go after a player like Kyle Kuzma, even though he would have been a perfect fit. I just can't see them making an additional move for a forward, even though they have a little bit of money left over. Ultimately, I think Kyle Kuzma ends up landing with the Indiana Pacers. No intel, no logic, no rationale. They have money, they have to give it to someone. And just close your eyes for a second. Picture Kyle Kuzma in a yellow and blue jersey. Should be pretty easy considering he's worn yellow before. And tell me it just doesn't make sense. PJ Washington ends up going to the San Antonio Spurs. Russell Westbrook ends up going to the Chicago Bulls. And just for shits and gigs, just because I want to see if I can maybe get one of these randos right, Rui Hachimura is going to be part of the Orlando Magic. So that's it. There you have it. My 2023 NBA free agency preview. I went a little in-depth, tried to give you a little bit of a discussional perspective on each player, what I think of their respective fit, and their predicted outcome as far as what I'm hoping for from the future of the NBA. Even though my picks may have been a little predictable, especially in terms of the larger cats, I do think that's generally how the NBA operates. This is a sport that has some of the most accurate and to-the-second coverage surrounding that. Trying to get things right, you would think would be a little bit easier, but because of so much conflicting information and the readily available access to it just by opening Twitter, rumors fly left and right, and it's very hard to sift and pick between which ones may have just been posted for the perspective of fan eruption, may have been posted for the perspective of assisting an agency, may have been posted directly from the player, or maybe coming from the team level itself. It's really hard to say, but at the end of the day, we just gotta wait and see. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to see you next time. Have a good one.